Today our Holy Father Pope Benedict XVI has appointed me the 9th Archbishop of the Great Archdiocese of St. Louis. I'm blessed by this appointment and excited to come to know this local church, to know its priests, its people, and all of its religious and its deacons as well.
That's Bishop Robert James Carlson, the next Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of St. Louis. Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the next Archbishop of St. Louis. He's making news, and he's making news for some very, I mean, if you think about his predecessors and about the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, for some very odd reasons, one of the main things they're reporting about him is, wow, he's pro-life. Dog bites man. That's what they call that kind of a story. We'll talk about him and his predecessors in the future of the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And the Food and Drug Administration has decided that if your daughter is 17, your son is 17, they can go to the pharmacist and without a prescription buy the morning after pill. It's fine with the FDA. Colleen Carroll Campbell will be our guest here for the first 10 minutes of the program, and then we'll spend the rest of this hour talking about prayer with Dr. Andrew Steinman. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-6943, or talkback at issuesetc.org. Colleen Carroll Campbell is a regular guest, St. Louis-based fellow for the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's author of the book, The New Faithful, and she writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Todd.
I'm wondering, there were critics of Archbishop Regali, of Archbishop Burke, the immediate predecessor to Bishop Carlson. Is Robert Carlson going to get the same kind of criticism as Burke and Regali?
Well, I think it'll certainly be along the same veins. I think there's a honeymoon period we're seeing right now with the local and secular press toward Bishop Carlson that will probably end as soon as there's some sort of local controversy on the life issues and he speaks out in defense of Catholic moral teaching, which, according to his record, is something he's quite comfortable doing. I think he'll do it in different ways than Archbishop Burke. Archbishop Burke was singularly bold, I would say, among American bishops, and I think that was a great blessing to the church in St. Louis. We may not see the same style or the same boldness in Bishop Carlson, but he certainly has a record of being very orthodox, of being a staunch defender of human life and of Catholic teaching. So I think the folks who think they might have a free ride with this bishop to dissent from Catholic doctrine and not have to get any rebukes are going to be in for a rude awakening.
Why is the headline surrounding Carlson and his entrance to the St. Louis Archdiocese that he's pro-life?
You know, I don't know. I think some of those headlines are pretty goofy, including some of the ones that say, you know, gee, he seems like sort of a nice person, kind of pastoral. and again, contrasting those two qualities as if they can't, of course, coexist in the same person. So I think a lot of the media coverage right now is a little bit silly. We did see more reports coming out now on his track record in Saginaw, Michigan, which was his previous diocese. And, of course, that suggests that he's going to pretty much toe the same line as Archbishop Burke and Cardinal Regali. And again, I think it's media scrutiny those bishops had, I think Bishop Carlson is probably in for that as well.
All right, then what should Roman Catholics in St. Louis and the surrounding area, of course we're talking here about the archdiocese stretching out into Missouri as well, but what should they expect, as far as we can tell, from the service of Robert Carlson?
Well, I think he prizes vocations to the priesthood. He considers that a top priority. We can see that in his record. He was very successful in Michigan in building up the vocations in that diocese, and he's indicated that's going to be a top priority here as well. So I think we'll see that. And in just reading some of his past letters to his flock in Michigan, I've seen a few common themes emerge. Defense of unborn life is one. He's very clearly pro-life, very clearly outspoken in his opposition not only to abortion but also to the destruction of human embryos for research. He will probably be not as outspoken publicly to pro-abortion Catholic politicians, but I think he certainly will continue in the vein of encouraging Catholics to be countercultural on these issues. In fact, in one letter he wrote what I thought was a pretty insightful analysis of the state of the church today, saying that, you know, when the country was younger and the Catholic Church in America was younger, it was very much an immigrant church, and Catholics were very worried about assimilating and fitting in. But he said, now is the time we need to start thinking about being countercultural because we blended in a little too well. So I think that's certainly, I think that's true, and I think that's the kind of insight that he needs to bring to St. Louis. And again, that's very much in line with Archbishop Burke's thoughts and his promotion of what Pope John Paul II called the new evangelization, that is sort of bringing the gospel again to the West, to a culture that has become utterly secularized.
Another story we wanted you to address, the FDA's decision yesterday with regard to the morning after pill and the age at which someone can buy the morning after pill without a prescription. If I want my daughter to have birth control, ordinary, the pill or something like that, the doctor has to prescribe it. The morning after pill is a higher dose of the same stuff, and how in the world, can you explain to me, does the FDA say they don't need a prescription for that?
Well, it certainly doesn't make a lot of sense to me. They are, this decision was prompted by a judge's decision, not surprisingly, in our activist courts. A U.S. District Court judge in New York was the one who pushed the FDA to do this, and the FDA and certainly, I'm sure, being under the Obama administration now, you know, decided that wasn't something they wanted to fight, as the Bush administration had been more strict on these things. You know, this is a real problem, and of course, news reports like to emphasize that the morning after pill is simply emergency contraception, but we know that one of the effects of it is that if a child has been conceived, if conception has already taken place, an egg has become fertilized and has become the very early stages of human life, this pill will prevent implantation of that human life in the woman's womb. So this is not simply contraception. This is also, at least in some cases, an abortifacient. So this is essentially bypassing parents' rights, not only on monitoring what their daughters are doing in terms of contraception, but also abortion, and it's bypassing a doctor. So these are women who are going to have access to this very powerful medication without even having to talk to a doctor or get any kind of medical follow-up for what could be, for instance, a great deal of sexual activity for which they should be monitored for STDs. So I think it's dangerous and a bad idea on all different levels.
Okay, so what's the political calculus here with those who want 17-year-olds to have both an abortifacient and an emergency contraceptive without a prescription? What are they hoping for?
Well, the argument has always been that this will reduce our teen pregnancy rate. Now, you can read any secular report you want, and they'll tell you that hasn't happened thus far. But somehow the idea is more and more contraception and abortion, and we'll see a lower teen pregnancy rate. Hasn't happened, but that's the plan. That's what they're saying is the benefit of this. Of course, it's also important to note that men 17 and older can buy Plan B for their partners. Now, I think we all know how that works. A 17-year-old man buying Plan B, or maybe a much older man buying this Plan B medication, may very well not be buying it for a 17-year-old girl, but even a 13-year-old girl, a 12-year-old girl. And again, parents out of the loop, doctors out of the loop, but the Planned Parenthood establishment, those folks say, well, you know, we do what it takes to prevent teen pregnancy. Hasn't been very effective in the past, but I think in their minds, any of those abuses are better than seeing teen pregnancy rates continue to be high.
Okay, then finally, what would you expect next from the FDA? I mean, how low will they go?
I think they'll continue to probably go lower, at least under the Obama administration. Already in the stories on this development today, the Planned Parenthood folks and other proponents of abortion and basically unlimited contraception to girls of any age are already saying, you know, this age is a little bit high. You know, we know kids are having sex at younger ages. Well, you know, we do know that's happening, and we could go pretty low on this, and I think that camp very much wants the age to be lowered and lowered. So this is sort of the camel's nose in the tent, and I think it will continue to be lowered, and I don't think there's really even a solid argument for not lowering it if you accept the premise that this decision was made upon. So that's why I think it's such a dangerous decision. It's not going to stop at 17. We see how especially these laws concerning abortion go. It's always moving toward the lowest common denominator and always never satisfied with sort of setting a certain bar. There's always a push for more and more radical policies, and we know that the Obama administration will support that. So I don't think there's a lot of question that this eventually will drop lower still unless there's a change of administrations before that can happen.
Folks, you can read the column written by Colleen Carroll Campbell at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Just go to the on-demand page. Colleen Carroll Campbell is a St. Louis-based fellow for the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's author of the book, The New Faithful, and she writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Colleen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about prayer. Now, you hear your pastor say the word prayer. You hear your fellow Christians talk about it. Maybe you do a little Bible study on the word prayer, and it is a guilt-inducing word, isn't it? Pray enough? Pray for everyone on your list? Praying in the right way? How sincere are you? Forget to pray? There's a lot of guilt associated with the word prayer, when in fact, if we examine Scripture's teaching on prayer, it should be the one thing least associated with guilt. It should be something completely free and completely open to us. We'll find out why on the other side of this break when Dr. Andrew Steinman, author of the book, Is God Listening? Making Prayer a Part of Your Life, joins us to talk about prayer. Stay tuned.